This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 13th of May 2014 on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Grundig. Hello and welcome to Section D, the hour we devote to the world of design each week here on Monocle 24. I'm your host, Tom Morris. Coming up today, we talk the golden age of corporate identity guidelines.
We're now at a stage where we can look at 60, 70, 80, 100 different typefaces in a matter of moments and change the formats easily. It's a much more flexible, fluent world.
We discover what happens when traditional folk dress meets haute couture in Austria.
This is Feinborn China. We had a manufacturer here called Augarten, and he had square tiles and made horrible bracelets. And we freed the bracelets and then made a porcelain t-shirt, which is elastic. I love the sound.
And we chat to the photographer behind a new book documenting the homes of European mid-century design masters.
You go in and it's like they're human beings and, you know, they designed these houses for themselves, but also, you know, you see patterns, you see, you know, where they like to work. All those things, I mean, it really just humanizes them.
That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. If you're like us and your idea of great bedtime reading is a slow flick through corporate identity guidelines, then you're in luck. London-based publisher Unit Editions has just launched a hardback gem called Manuals 1, Design and Identity Guidelines. The 432-page tome is a comprehensive and chronological study of 21 CI manuals from the 1960s, 70s and the early 1980s. Lovingly reproduced by the team, case studies stretch from Lufthansa's 1963 guidelines to the manual produced by Banks and Miles for British Telecom in 1981. There are also contributions from Massimo Vignelli and Richard Dan, who designed the NASA guidelines, which is also profiled in the volume. To talk over the book and to discuss the heyday of identity design, I'm now joined by Unit Editions' Tony Brook and our very own creative director, Rich Spencer-Powell. So to start with, Tony, how did you go about choosing these 21 examples in the book?
It kind of evolved, really. When we were first setting up Unit Editions, I had a wish list of books that I wanted us to do. And one of them was manuals. And every time I came across a manual, I'd take some snaps of it and record it. And it just kept building this idea until eventually I had so many of them, it just had to happen, really. There were some that definitely wanted examples of by Massimo Vignelli and by Wim Crowell and Paul Rand, so some of the real greats. But I'd also come across quite a few that were kind of more obscure, and I thought they were really exciting as well. Mm. But what I was really aware of was that you don't see them. They're kind of like hidden away on dusty shelves, and you know, you don't get to see these things. So it was an incredibly exciting thing for me coming across them. I just hope that everybody agreed that, you know, when they saw them, that they'd feel the same way. So it's strange because I've been reasonably confident with most of the books that we've done that there would be an audience for it. But this was the first one where I was honestly genuinely scared that there was just me and my nerdy love of corporate identity guideline manuals.
Yeah.
So it was a big relief that I wasn't alone.
You're right, you don't see them. I don't think I've ever come across too many. I mean, I've seen websites that where they're trading for like £1,000 on, I remember the RAC guidelines book was, everyone absolutely wanted to get their hands on it. So there must have been a huge research component in actually acquiring these things. Because one of the nice things about this book is, you know, you've actually physically got the books and photographed them and shown them. It's not just about the work within the manual, it's about how the manual itself was put together.
There was a big research aspect to it. A lot of internet trawling. We had some fantastic contributors around the place who we found through their websites and through Flickr and what have you that we contacted. So it's been a real trawl and a real labour of love to get it together.
When you're sort of designing the book, obviously corporate identity guidelines are primarily functional things. Mm-hmm. How did you go about turning that into also an enjoyable read?
They are functional things, but they're also beautiful things. And there's an element of instruction, but there's also an element of formal beauty about them. And so we were really keen to celebrate that, the way they were built, the way they were made. I think that a lot of the people that we asked to contribute to the book really make it for a much richer book than it might otherwise have been. So yeah, you mentioned Massimo Vignelli, but also people like Sean Perkins, who's fanatical about these things. So, and I think that these contributors made it a rich, entertaining read, not just an analytical overview of corporate identity guidelines. It's, I mean, at the base of it, it's about love, not facts and hard-edged logos. It's about adoring these objects.
What are some of your favourites, particularly more of the more obscure ones?
There's one called Northern Natural Gas, which I think is just the most beautiful logo, and I'd never seen that before. My own personal favourite, which is not so obscure, but I'd never thought I'd actually lay my hands on it, so it meant a lot to me because it's one of the keystones in terms of logo design for me, was the British Steel guidelines, which isn't one of the big ones. It's quite thin in terms of how many pages it is and what have you, but David Gentleman's logo, I thought, was one of the archetypal logos, so I couldn't believe it when he actually sent me a copy of that. I was stroking that for a long time.
And Rich, what about you? What are some of your favourites, some standouts?
I won't say a favourite. I'll say a favourite page, which is part of the NASA manual. And there's often when you do manuals, there's exclusion zones and colour palettes. And there's often a page which is the sort of don'ts, which is don't abuse the logo and don't stretch it and don't do this to it and all sorts of things. And it's almost audacious for NASA to suggest that someone would do something wrong with their logo. And the sweet thing about it is that they've done sort of 9 alternative logos to their own logo, and all of them are actually quite nice. It's brilliant, and it's just a little gem within a sort of amazing, you know, archive, really. And you just wouldn't see all those things in one place ever. I can't think. I mean, these things almost belong in a museum. It should be in a design museum, and you should be able to go and look and learn. And I think it's great that you've managed to acquire them.
Yeah.
I hope they're in a safe somewhere.
We had to send them back, but I agree with you absolutely. It's interesting about the NASA identity was that nothing good came from Tricky Dicky, Richard Nixon, but his government was responsible for commissioning that, and the next lot got rid of it straight away as soon as they came in, which is just heartbreaking. Because again, it's one of the great logos.
How do you judge the way the world of graphic design and the way graphic designers work has changed in the sort of 30, 40 years since a lot of these were made?
It's changed hugely, but I mean, that's because of the advent of computers. But having said that, you can almost see some of these guidelines preempting the use of computers, the way the digital, they're almost like digital grids that they apply these things to. We're now at a stage where we can look at 60, 70, 80, 100 different typefaces in a matter of moments and change the formats easily. It's a much more flexible, fluent world. I think that none of these identities would be necessarily made with animation in mind, but almost all identities now have to have an animation component to them when they appear on screen or at the start of a screen presentation or something. So nearly all of the identities that we create now have got to be successful on a letterhead, a website, a screen-based presentation. So it's a very different world. And also, it's become a much more image-rich world, and so the way that an identity lives isn't so monochromatic anymore in its physical nature either. So, you know, in terms of colours used, the flexibility of application, it's really very, very broad. The thing is that we don't get so often now to put things on the sides of trucks or things like that, which obviously was a time when you could.
I think everything's got a bit smaller. And yeah, you're right, you design a logo and primarily you're thinking about a letterhead or a business card. That's kind of where you start. But then, of course, it has to fit on an iPhone and then a banner ad and then a banner ad on a tablet and God knows what next, an iWatch or something. And then, you know, things are going to get more and more multifaceted. So it's just a sort of simpler discipline back then.
One thing I did notice, it is pan-global, the book, but many of the examples are US.
Well, that was the heart of corporate design for many years. And so it's also a matter of what we can get our grubby mitts on, you know, what we can find. But we've since the book came out, a lot more manuals have been coming out of the woodwork. So
what's in manuals two?
One that's definitely going to be in manuals two is the Canadian Railways identity, which is a work of rare beauty. And I think that's going to be pretty special. We've got PTT from the Dutch Post Office that Gert Dunbar did. That's pretty cool. I'd never seen that before, and that's pretty exciting. There's Walter Beale did a beautiful one. It was a paper manufacturer, and it's a tree in a circle, and it's just sublime. That's from the late 50s. That's quite an early one. But we're working with Roger Remington from the Rochester Institute in the States, and they've got a fantastic collection there. So that's kind of forming the basis of it. That's where the Massimo Vignelli archive is as well. So I went there recently with Adrian.
Lots of plunder there.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Rich, anything you'd like to see in there?
We mentioned North earlier on. I wondered if you'd come right up to contemporary 90s, 2000s, anything that recent?
That was Volume 3. But we are looking at, I don't, that seriously, there might well be looking in Volume 3. I mean, they're just beautiful things. And it would be lovely to show how the development's gone through the 56 and bring it up to date at the end. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. Be very sexy.
Tony and Rich, thank you very much for joining me on Section D. As Portugal celebrates the 40th anniversary of the revolution that rid the country of its fascist dictatorship, remnants of that time still exist, not in politics, but in the packaging of products that are now back in fashion. Communications designer Nuno Coelho talks to Saima Tarek about the legacy of Portugal's visual identity that precedes the 20th century, but, as his research finds, was cemented during the Estado Novo.
Eis que os nossos soldados aceitam com reconhecimento o cravo vermelho no cano das suas espingardas.
I would say that we have like a very strong imagery from Portugal thanks to the dictatorship. There was a strong sense of trying to keep a record of everything that was being produced everywhere.
Graphic and communications designer Nuno Coelho is now an expert on an aspect of Portuguese history that many others don't give much thought to. The packaging on everyday items, from soap to sardine tins, that has been preserved until today.
I was working on, recently, my PhD research, which was all packaging that still exists today. Because in Portugal, it's a particular case where many packages kept their designs through the ages until today. And now that all designs are being evaluated in a different way, to be more precise, I was studying the shift from those packagings to be a more pragmatic, functional thing that we think about more like to transport, to inform, etc. But now that all packaging is being sold now as a more trendy, I would say.
A revived interest in old products is, like in much of the rest of Europe, coincidental with the general trend for vintage or retro design. But the fact that it is happening in Portugal for the first time is no coincidence, as Nuno explains.
Portugal had the longest dictatorship in Western Europe, 48 years. And after the revolution that kicked out the dictatorship in 1974, Portugal was invaded by all the products that were coming from the rest of the world. There was an economic boom in the 80s. And that generation that was buying products in the 80s ceased to buy the old Portuguese products because they started to associate those products with backwardness, repression, and concepts like that. People were just amazed with all the products, glittering products that were coming from outside. During the dictatorship, there was protective of the Portuguese industry. There was a lot of trying to not to compete with the foreign products. So those brands, really old brands, that some started in the late 19th century, many companies went bankrupt, some survived, but then suddenly, after the change of the 20th to the 21st century, there's this new hype around those old brands, mainly because of a project Vida Portuguesa, which means the Portuguese life, that now currently has three shops, two in Lisbon and one in Porto. And they recovered all those brands, old brands, and now it's trendy, I would say, to buy those products, mainly because there's a whole generation which is already adult and can buy things that didn't grow up during the dictatorship. So there's a different way to relate to those products. And I was studying that swift between that's the same product that has the same shape when it was sold during the dictatorship to as a function, the packaging as a functional thing, like to sell the product, but now is more like a symbol. People buy it because of concepts like nostalgia. There's a Portuguese word which is untranslatable for other languages, which is so that, which is mean something like longing or a mix of nostalgia with sad feeling. And I was trying to studying that thing, like how memory works, how memory sometimes can be forged, sometimes can be like you can have a memory of a past that you didn't live in. So that was what interested me the most, and that's what I've been doing in the last few years. That's my main focus of interest now in the design.
The power of communicating visually through trademarks, brands and image strategies is common to most organizations. And it was no different for the Salazar regime. Everything from pencil design to handicrafts had official schemes behind how they looked. One factory, Confianza, that made and packaged soap with around 1,000 different labels, is one case study that Nuno took up as a way to map those design strategies.
That was keeping a record of when and who designed that label and trying to establish a parallel between those designs and the economical, social, political and cultural life in Portugal. There was one man called António Ferro, and he was the director of the regime propaganda. Because he was coming from the cultural life, he was a writer and a critic. So he established what the culture should be. He wrote like a few guidelines. And for example, in that period when the dictatorship was established, you can see on the designs that before were a bit Art Nouveau and then Art Deco, and then suddenly it was very modernistic. In the 40s and then 50s, like in these labels of the soap that I was studying from Confianza, which is the name of the factory, you can see the ideals of the regime. First, like the names of the brands, the names they picked for the brands of the soap. So there was lots of words associated with the regime. For example, Patria, which means nation, and that was a brand of very simple, plain colors, labels, but with very picturesque things. For example, this brand for almost every typical village in Portugal. There's women dressed with the folk dresses on those labels. So you have like a visual map of what the culture then should be. During the dictatorship, they rebuilt many Portuguese castles. Plenty of castles. It was just like stones, like completely collapsed, and they rebuilt it, and they changed the castles. Not even in Portugal, not many people know about that. So it was semi-fake, semi-real, so it was this limbo. And for example, we're not really sure sometimes when something that we think that is very Portuguese, is it because it is very like century old, or it was just fabricated then? So there's still lots of things that we can research and trying to find what is heritage of the dictatorship or not.
As Portuguese consumers and designers continue to look to their past, Nuno's mapping of his country's design history tells the story of a brighter future. For Monocle in Lisbon, I'm Saima Tarek.
Thanks, Saima. You're listening to Section D. We'll be back after this short break to hear about the architectural highlights of rural Britain.
For over six decades, Grundig has made people's lives better and simpler. To this day, we bring our expert knowledge of design and technology to a wide range of high-quality domestic appliances. Whether refrigerator or radio, oven or audio system, we continue to integrate our manufacturing heritage with state-of-the-art technology. Grundig synthesizes the best of yesterday with the best of tomorrow, expertly and innovatively designed for you and your home. Grundig. Supreme Engineering, Timeless Design.
You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris. Rolling hills and grassy fields. That's what most people think of when they imagine the English countryside. But architect and curator Corinna Dean is trying to change that. In her new book, Slacklands, she's attempting to direct public attention to the built environment in the British rural landscape, which she calls British Rural Contemporary Architecture. At her book opening, Haley Joel Ott asked her just what these kind of buildings are.
They are anything from industrial buildings or power stations. Some of them are more or less ruins, you know, they're vacant. Some of them are old military buildings, and quite a few of them are old Cold War structures which might have housed atomic, you know, weaponry. So they were not well known at all, so they're only now becoming known in the public realm.
And why bring them into public attention?
Well, I studied architecture, and I'm very interested in sort of brutalist architecture and also the relationship these buildings have to the landscape. And a lot of them are in kind of sort of scruffy areas of the landscape. So my sort of focus is to open up a dialogue about the British landscape that is not purely about the picturesque. You know, these are quite difficult landscapes. They're quite sort of scruffy, sort of overlooked, quite a difficult aesthetic. So the idea is that the buildings are kind of slightly awkward, and they kind of make us question what the countryside is in Britain.
A lot of the buildings do look quite industrial, and some of them are run down and have been called a blight on the British landscape. What would you say to people who've said that?
Well, I think there's a certain, well, for me, there's a certain beauty in the strength of the architecture. They've been driven by the function. So a lot of them are very well built. They're very durable. They're kind of very heroic. They're very sculptural, and they're not apologetic. So I think those are the elements that I was drawn towards.
And you've created a guidebook for these buildings. What do you want people to do with that?
Well, ideally, people can either sit in their armchair and just view the buildings and imagine the journeys, or I would like them to go and visit the buildings, or, you know, take walks around about them and kind of look at the landscape.
And how would that change, do you think, how people feel about the British landscape?
I think that it will sort of open up debate and dialogue about these spaces and encourage appreciation of them. And, I mean, some of the buildings which are looking for new uses, I think by bringing them into the public consciousness, you know, they could actually find quite exciting contemporary uses for them.
What is the most interesting piece that you think is in your book?
Well, I must say, when I saw a picture of number one grain battery tower, which is on the Thames estuary, I was quite struck by the contrast of the architecture, because the original structure is from the early 20th century, late 19th century, and then there's an army barracks that's been built next to it. So you have this kind of, you have this amazing contrast of the two structures. So it's such a kind of strange kind of conglomeration of architecture, and it's set on an estuary, and when you can only reach it when it's low tide. So there's a real kind of drama around it as well.
Do you think for people to appreciate this architecture in a way that they haven't before, there would need to be a shift in the way that people think about the built environment in relation to the natural one?
Yeah, well, I think often these buildings are in the landscape for a purpose. You know, for example, the nuclear power station was built where it was, next to the North Sea, because it needed the seawater to cool the reactors. So there's a necessity for them to be there. So I think by kind of embracing the architecture rather than ignoring it is quite an important aspect, just in terms of opening up your knowledge about these, this kind of architecture. And some of them have been influential in terms of their styles in more kind of domestic pieces of architecture.
What does this architecture give us in terms of an understanding of British history?
Yeah, I think the Cold War structures are amazing, because a lot of them weren't known. You'd have people living a few miles down the road, they'd have no idea that they were living next to one of the largest storage sites of nuclear weaponry. It's just kind of revealing this history of the buildings. So I think the guidebook is quite instrumental in terms of introducing, you know, this kind of little-known history to the public.
That was architect and curator Corinna Dean in conversation with our Haley Joel Ott. And Slacklands is out now. Now, in fashion, mixing old with the new can often lead to some extremely creative results. Indeed, for Austrian fashion designer Suzanne Bizofsky, this combination has been a winning one. A student of Vivian Westwood and Helmut Lang, Bisovsky has been in fashion for more than 20 years, indulging her childhood passion for traditional costume by merging Germanic and Slavic folk dresses with haute couture and producing a colourful medley with a hefty price tag. Our Austria contributor, Alexei Korolyov, met Bisovsky at her studio in Vienna, where she told him all about her unusual designs.
That's what we call the salon, and what we basically do, or Susanne does, is she does haute couture and prêt-à-porter.
This is Josef Gerger, Susanne Bisovsky's partner and a fellow designer. Together with her, he showed me around their lavishly decorated studio just off central Vienna.
Behind the curtains is the haute couture, and what you see here is what people can buy when they come in and want to buy something. She has a big archive of traditional clothes, and this is her inspiration.
Everywhere you look around this room, there are rows upon rows of precious multicolored dresses, shirts, hats and shoes, some of Bisovsky's own making, some from antiquarian shops and flea markets she regularly scours for lucky finds. All this is encased in grand vintage furniture and huge bundles of flowers. An atmosphere that keeps her in a working frame of mind, Bisovsky tells me.
It's very important to live and the place where I work.
This is Feinborn China. We had a manufacturer here called Augarten, and he had square tiles and made horrible bracelets. And we freed the bracelets and then made a porcelain t-shirt, which is elastic. I love the sound.
Yeah. I like the traditional details, but to bring it in a new form.
Right.
But the basic is traditional. For me, it's very interesting, the special techniques from traditional things in Vienna, especially petit pois, Augarten,
porcelain.
Porcelain, and I call it Viennese rose. For me, it's important that women wear my clothes. It's one of the most important things.
Not many people, however, even among Bisovsky's clients, understand this.
Roses, and that's all. That's enough for 90% of the clients.
It's a trend, but that's the trend which is not understood very well. Those are those people which they don't look at what she does. They rather take it as a funny traditional interpretation of, you know, what we call doodling or something.
And while, by her own admission, Bisovsky doesn't feel any less fulfilled for that, her crossover approach has been treated with far more consideration by fashion critics.
So she's one of the few designers who are actually able to make a living by working for Austrian fashion houses.
Daniel Kalt, a writer at the Viennese daily Die Presse, is one such critic and admirer.
I think it's wonderful what she does. If everybody were doing that, it would be a bit boring, but it's always the same in fashion and in design. But I think that her way of approaching the fashion that she designs is unique, and she was one of the first to do it. And she is of tremendous importance for the Austrian fashion scene.
This promotional video shows the dazzling variety of traditions evoked and employed by Bisovsky. From Germanic peasant costume to early 20th century Viennese fashion to Eastern European and even Russian designs. Fashion writer Daniel Kalt explains about some of these.
There is different kinds of traditions, because you've got the tradition of traditional Austrian costume, which was neglected for a very long time after the end of World War II, for obvious reasons, because it was very closely connected to the aesthetics that were, you know, of the Nazi regime. And then you've got the tradition of the early 20th century, which was a lot more modern than what happened afterwards, but you see that in Austria and you see it in different countries. It's like Chanel and this whole thing of going back to the roots of Austrian costume and Austrian tradition. I think that is something that you see internationally, and that just took off some few years ago, and it responds to the need of Austrian customers of wanting to see someone more natural and less artificial and, you know, more sustainable.
was ich versuche zu machen, keine Modeerscheinung ist, sondern mm-hmm.
ein Back at her flowery studio, Bisowski reveals her ultimate working method.
I love fashion and trends because they're coming and they're going, and I wait. I have time. Difficult and difficulter. Oder wie sagt man?
Yeah, more difficult.
More difficult to find old clothes and special techniques.
But your archive is full. My archive is 10 lives, right?
Meine Vision für die Zukunft ist, dass...
One of her visions of the future is that she is in 10 years, she's still as fascinated within her work as she is now.
Bisowski was a pioneer of this experimental blending of tradition and modernity when she started her career in fashion in the 1990s, and she will no doubt remain at the avant-garde of this movement in the years to come. For Monocle in Vienna, I'm Alexei Korolev.
Coming up, we get inside the homes of Alvaro Aalto and Carlo Mellino, and we look into our crystal ball to see what stories from Asia you should be keeping your eyes on.
Grundig's goal is to bring the best of the world's entertainment into your home. Its digital and DAB Plus radios allow you to access an unlimited choice of broadcasters from around the world and to listen to them with the most superior sound quality. Its new Bluetooth-enabled audio products let you play music from your smartphone. Grundig is committed to making sound crystal clear, whether it's beaming in from the other side of the world or from a mobile right next to you. Grundig. Supreme engineering, timeless design.
Welcome back to Section D with me, Tom Morris. Modern Originals, at home with mid-century European designers, is the new tome by Leslie Williamson. The California-based photographer visited the residences of some of the most influential designers of Europe, both deceased and living, and has collated the end results in this, her second book. The 13 chapters cover everything from Aino and Alvaro Aalto's cool, calm and collected home in Helsinki to Le Corbusier's dinky summer house in the south of France. And Leslie joins me now to discuss her adventures. Let's start off with, I mean, how many years has this been in the planning for?
The first book, which was Handcrafted Modern, kind of stemmed from this large list that I dreamed up in like 2005, maybe, which was worldwide and kind of just me dreaming of where all the places I wanted to go and see before I left the earth, all my favorite designers. And so in some way, I guess it started back then. But then I did Handcrafted, which was all in the United States. And that was a personal project when I was shooting it the whole time. So it did nicely. And when it did nicely, I decided, okay, Europe's next. And so I started shooting in early 2012. And basically, I shot all that year. 4 months about straight over here.
Yeah.
Or actually two trips, 2 months each. And then 2013 was like going through, making chapters, sequencing everything, writing everything, designing, you know.
Yeah, a real labor of
love. Not that I design, but I do everything else kind of with the help of an editor, of course.
And how did you go about, I mean, I loved in your intro at the beginning, the criteria of how you went about choosing and selecting the shortlist.
Yeah.
What were the points on that?
It stems from the original list. Mm-hmm. And then from there, you know, like some houses that I really wanted to do, they were no longer like around because, I mean, it was a while ago that I made the list. And then summer museums. So then you can like easily email and, you know, I have a book now that I can send them. And so, and then there's others that, you know, designers that I really like and I try and find an intro to them somehow. That's always better. And then some you just stumble across, luckily.
Yeah.
Josef Nemec in the Czech Republic. A friend of mine mentioned him to me and introduced me. But I mean, it's all kind of... It's rather organic.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I have like a dream list I start from and then, you know, like one person drops out and like 10 minutes later I get an email from someone who hadn't responded. So, I mean, I kind of just take it all as a sign.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think what's lovely about this book is it's this kind of slight, it's the change in scale between, you know, like Alvaro Aalto's house, which a lot of people would have seen before, but you shot it in your own specific way.
Yeah.
It makes it look very different. But then, yeah, Le Corbusier's
little tiny... I love that.
And that's gorgeous. Tell us about that. How was that experience?
Well, so I decided that I had to shoot it in August when he would be there. and it was hotter than Hades in that little room.
But what is it? It's like 100 square feet, isn't it?
Like 145.
Yeah.
But it was kind of amazing to do that, you know, because it's like I want to experience the house like the owners would if they're no longer living, you know. It's like, how would it be to live here? So I think about like, what are the sounds I'm hearing? What does it smell like? I mean, he was in love with, you know, swimming, and so it's on a little footpath. It's not on a road or anything. Mm. So, you know, it's like I can see him walking with his towel to the beach. And yeah, but when you get in there, it's incredibly hot, and it was all closed up, so dark.
Yeah.
And then you'll like, it's not that bright of a space.
Mm.
I was reading something the other day where they talked about how it was so bright and airy, and I was like, you have never been in there. It is not bright. I mean, the windows aren't incredibly large, but it is beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, the light in there is really beautiful.
Yeah. It looks sort of twinking with Riviera light.
And the other thing about it is it's so small. So I was kind of like, I really thought a lot about if I should include it because it's been photographed.
Yeah.
So much.
Yeah.
But I've decided not to do that anymore because I went in there and it's like the tiniest space. And I discovered all these things that I had never seen. There's like this little towel bar that's like hidden. And I was like, oh, brilliant. I mean, and it's those little things that I enjoy the most, yeah. I guess.
How do you shoot? I mean, you shoot sort of solo, don't you?
I do. It's just me and a lot of equipment.
Yeah. And do people, sort of the people who now manage the house or look after them, back off and leave you alone? Is that?
Yeah. I mean, yes, mostly. I mean, so it's me. I don't bring lights. It's just me and my camera and whatever light is available in the house, because that's how it would be if they lived there. And I shoot for 2 days. I mean, Le Corbusier, I did not shoot for 2 days, but most of them I shoot for 2 days and just move around with the light. And yeah, when the owners are living there, they usually forget I'm there.
Sure. Yeah.
So, yeah. But house museums, sometimes there'll be like a person that has to stay with me.
Yeah.
Only in one house that I can remember, actually. Oh, no, two. But, you know, I mean, watching a photo shoot is like watching paint dry. It's not that exciting. Especially, you know, if there's really nothing to watch. So.
Yeah. And it must be an amazing experience just to be sort of locked in these places by yourself, photographing them for 2 days. How does it sort of change? I mean, if there's any examples of how it's changed the way you sort of perceive a designer and how they worked because of you sort of really being immersed in how they lived.
It always changes. It changes how I see them every single time.
Mm.
Mainly because it, you know, I mean, I go in and I'm just like, oh, I love their work and... I mean, they're kind of icons, most of them, and you go in and it's like they're human beings and, you know, they've designed these houses for themselves, but also, you know, you see patterns, you see, you know, where they like to work, where as opposed to, like in Fignul's house, he had a little office,
yeah,
like off the front door, but I'm pretty sure he worked in his living room all the time.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's kind of nice to see those little, I don't know, daily patterns and also seeing people's kitchens and... like where they kept their clothes and all those things. I mean, it really just humanizes them in a way that, I don't know, just, I mean, it makes me love them more, honestly, but...
Absolutely. But and I always think a great sort of interiors photograph is, it's where you get the real, yeah, the trace of humanity, and it's like someone's just walked out of the room, which is obviously problematic if, you know, they died 20 years ago. But it's those kind of details which I think you're particularly strong at picking up on. How do you sort of go about what kind of, when you go into a room, you sort of do you go directly to their bookshelves or?
I am a little obsessed with their books. It is well known, you know, amongst my friends. But I trained as a photographer of people and a portraitist. So I actually see homes as just an extended portrait of whoever lived there.
Mm.
I think, I mean, I also just love little things. Especially because these people designed these houses for themselves. It's like, so every choice in there is like what they would do for themselves.
Yeah.
It's not like a client. So that, you know, deepens your understanding of them as well.
Yeah. And there's a couple of great examples, isn't there, when you talk about the letterbox.
Oh, Renaud Brahms. Yeah. His letterbox, he used to always get architectural drawings, so he totally customized it with like this long chute and a place for letters. And I mean, I thought it was for a cat or something, actually. I had to ask because I was just like, wow, what is happening there? It's quite elaborate. Yeah, but I mean, I love all those little things.
The great design solutions that these guys could...
Oh, gosh, yes. Love that. I always have, like a little list going in my head. I keep joking that I'm going to make a book about like tips on remodeling from all the greats, you know, because I always take pictures of those things.
Yeah.
And most of them don't make it in the book, honestly. Mm. So, you know.
What I think is good about the book as well is, you know, it is all about mid-century design, which is obviously very varied. But it's a real kind of portfolio of the different national takes on it. Obviously, the couple of Italian ones you've got in here are very kind of flamboyant and beautiful. And then you've got the Nordic and Finnish ones, which are much more minimalist. How did you, as a sort of collective whole, how do you sort of see it reads as a kind of a memoir of mid-century design?
I mean, I enjoy like the differences, you know. I mean, someone said to me that like mid-century modern is such an American thing, which is like, I don't think of it like that at all. But I thought it was just fascinating to see all the differences. And I loved, you know, Carlo Molino as opposed to Bruno Mazzone. I mean, it's like, I find the differences of everybody so much more intriguing than the commonalities. So I don't know.
Yeah.
La différence.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's a great, I mean, what's lovely to see as well is just the sort of the eclecticism of all the homes. And I think you imagine a sort of designer's home would be quite sort of sparse and strict and disciplined, whereas actually the higgledy-piggledy-ness of many of these homes is what's so charming about them.
I know. And I mean, let's face it, we're all like that. It's kind of reassuring to know that they're not all perfect.
Leslie, thank you very much for joining us on Section D. And Modern Originals, Leslie Williamson's book, published by Rizzoli, is out now. Now to end the show, let's look to the week ahead on the design calendar. It's been a while since we did our Section D regional focus, so to kick it off again, let's head to Asia. Our Tokyo bureau chief, Fiona Wilson, is on hand to run us through some of the more standout design stories on her patch. So let's start with M+, which is a huge Museum of Visual Culture opening in Hong Kong in 2017. And the architecture and design curator, Eric Chen's been in town, hasn't he, in Tokyo?
He has. He's been shopping. Lucky man. He's you know, got a very generous budget. Basically, this huge new museum is opening in Hong Kong in 2017. And it's a very vague title. It's described as a museum of visual culture, which seems to include, you know, architecture, design, painting, all sorts of visual arts, obviously. And Eric Chen is in charge of the design and architecture section. And he's just bought, rather interestingly, a sushi restaurant, which is designed by Shiro Kuramata, who he died in 1991, Kuramata, but he's rated as one of the really big names in Japanese design in the 20th century. And he did quite a lot of interiors, but very few of them remain. And what they're doing is they've bought this sushi restaurant in Tokyo, which he designed in 1988, and they're taking it lock, stock and barrel to Hong Kong, where they're going to rebuild it in the museum.
What sort of questions of ownership does this bring up? I mean, how does Tokyo feel about quite an iconic piece of design being shipped to Hong Kong?
Well, I mean, there are two sides to this. I think there's been a bit of noise in Hong Kong about the cost of this thing, apart from anything. They paid 15 million Hong Kong dollars, apparently, and they're going to spend another 2 million moving it to Hong Kong. So on one side, you've got people in Hong Kong saying, hang on, that's quite expensive. And on this side, I think, you know, generally people have seen Tokyo taken apart, rebuilt, bombed. Many things have happened to Tokyo in its history. So architecturally, people are very used to seeing things come and go. But I think there is a bigger issue around design, which is becoming a bit, I think people are talking about it more and more, which is that Japan doesn't have a design museum, which is really hard to believe. That there's a very small museum, well, sort of gallery space, really, called 2121 Design Site in Tokyo Midtown, which is a small exhibition space. I'm sure you've been there. But it doesn't really qualify as a design museum. Nobody is collecting Japanese contemporary modern design. And I think this is raising these issues, is that everything's up for sale, could go anywhere. And I've seen some very interesting collections, very interesting collection of chairs, for example, Japanese design chairs, which there's nowhere for them to go. And I think that if somebody, in fact, the owner told me that he'd had interest from Korea and Taiwan, and if somebody made an offer, he would sell them. So I think more generally, there's a big issue about what is Japan going to do. You know, design is a huge industry for Japan, and it's a very good, I think it's a real soft power exercise for Japan, its strength in design. So should really be doing more to celebrate Japanese design.
Mm. Is M+, I mean, it's international, isn't it? Or is it more of a showcase of Asia-wide design?
It says it's international, but definitely the focus is Asia. Mm. I think it wants to be the sort of premier place to go and see contemporary and modern Asian art and design. So I think that's the focus. And it makes sense. I mean, really, given the location, you've already got brilliant museums in London, New York. So it's like, what could they do that was a bit different? And it's really interesting because nobody has really explored here. If you were to have a budget and you wanted to create a design museum, what would you buy here? You know, it's interesting that those questions haven't really been raised in Japan. And he's starting with a blank sheet. I mean, Kuramata is a huge name. There's nothing particularly obscure about him at all. So I guess he'd be on a list of if somebody was going to be doing that kind of thing here. But the sushi restaurant will be gone for good. And in fact, they're having a farewell cocktail party at the end of the month. The last time all the stools that he designed will be there. That's all going. So, I mean, I think it'll be quite interesting. I will go along to that. I'll be raising a glass to Kuramata.
And also happening at the end of the month is a paper show, isn't there, with Takeo?
Yes. Now, this paper company, it does sound quite an unusual idea, this, but this paper company, Takeo, has been in business since 1899. Family company. Paper geeks go nuts for this place. It does every kind of detailed kind of paper for printing. I mean, you just want to go and look at the papers, feel them, amazing textures. And every year, it was every year, they do a show where they basically get designers involved to do something interesting with paper. In fact, the last one was in 2011, the earthquake and tsunami put a pause on their activities on that front. So this year, it's the 47th show, in fact. It's been going for a long time. And Kenya Hara, the designer, is very involved with Takeo. He's been involved with them for a long time, and he's the director of the show. So he manages to pull in some big names to get involved in what is quite an esoteric show. I mean, you know, there's people like Junya Ishigami, very successful young architect. You've got Akira Minagawa, who's the name behind Mina Pahonen, which is a fashion brand. You've got quite interesting people, Bunpei Yorifuji, who's a graphic designer. It's a really interesting collection of people who were apparently all picked because they have the right kind of skills for this year's theme, which is called subtle. It's subtle. So I think that's quite funny, given that everything is in very subtle white paper. It could hardly be more subtle, this show. So it should be an interesting one.
Are we talking about big installations or just sort of cleverly arranged pieces of paper? What would it actually look like?
No, they're very small and very delicate. I mean, it's just purely, not for fun, I wouldn't say just for fun, but it promotes the company, obviously, in the paper, but it's so conceptual. They've got some photographs, actually, on the press preview will be coming up in a couple of weeks. And they sent some photographs, and Junya Ishigami's work is called Spring, and it almost looks like mustard and cress growing, but in paper. It's very tiny and very delicate. So it's not huge chunks of paper. It's sort of the opposite. It's very, very fine work, and it's, you know, it requires some concentration. I've seen this show in the past, and it's quite different depending on who's involved in the show. I think this year it's a very, very impressive bunch of people who are, you know, all quite different in terms of what they do. But it's a small scale. I think the small scale is really what's appealing about it. It's very, very delicate.
And subtle.
Very subtle, exactly. Perfect.
And there's another exhibition at the moment as well, which you're interested by.
It's quite an ongoing exhibition, this one. It's basically about the Tokyo Central Post Office, which is, or I should say was, a very fine building built in 1931. It's right by Tokyo Station. I mean, you know, when you look into it, Tetsuro Yoshida, the architect, he was actually in the buildings and repairs department of the Ministry of Communications. He wasn't, you know, an A-list architect, but what he did was brilliantly simple. And the building just came to be seen as this, it's very white, very clean looking. It came to be seen as this sort of symbol of Tokyo after the 1923 earthquake, which really devastated the city. It really flattened the city. And the post office was a symbol of renewal. And really, the post office, Japanese post office, there was always long talk of privatisation. And one of the key bits of this was, right, we're going to demolish this post office and build a massive tower. The compromise was that they kept the front of the post office and some of the interior, and they've built a very tall 38-storey tower behind it called JP Tower, Japan Post Tower. And this exhibition basically looks at the process of not exactly dismantling it, but converting the old post office and incorporating it into this, what has become a very popular thing in Tokyo, facadism, which a lot of people really don't like, where you just keep the front of the building, really, and the issues around that. And they created a space within this post office, which is like a gallery space called the Intermediatek, is the longer word, but they call it IMT. And it's a sort of gallery space that they use for different exhibitions, different projects. And they're just looking at how they how they managed to sort of use the old building. So it's sort of bittersweet, I think, because I was very fond of the old post office, but I'm glad they didn't demolish it entirely.
Monocle's Tokyo Bureau Chief, Fiona Wilson, thank you very much. And that brings us to the end of today's show. It was produced by Aled John and edited by Holly Fisher. You can contact the producer Aled at awj@monocle.com if you'd like to feature on the show or if you have any comments or questions. I'm Tom Morris. And to play you out, in honour of Leslie Williamson and her book documenting the residences of Europe's modern-day masters, here's Home by Sheryl Crow. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye. This is Home.